Welcome to Teleclass 4 of the World Peace Diet Circle. I'm your host, Steve Prusak, and tonight we'll be joined by Dr. Will Tuttle and our special guest, Melanie Joy. Melanie Joy is the author of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, An Introduction to Carnism, the belief system that enables us to eat some animals and not others. Course downloads for tonight are available on the membership website under the tab for Teleclass 4 Listen Live. There are two articles for downloads this week. And we invite you to be active during the call tonight. We'll welcome your questions for Melanie Joy later in the evening. Just press star 2 to raise your hand or submit a question directly in the membership site under Teleclass 4 Listen Live. You can go ahead and type it in there throughout the evening. We'll receive them, so it's pretty instantaneous. We'd like to welcome all the new students currently enrolled in the Mastery and Facilitator training programs. You'll receive a new course module each week. And additionally, we'll be hosting the second teleclass each month, a more informal conversation directly with Dr. Tuttle to support you on your journey. Will's going to tell you more about that later tonight. Well, please continue to stay connected and active in the community forum located in the membership website. And right now, I'd like to introduce to you the author of The World Peace Diet and visionary artist behind our virtual programs, Dr. Will Tuttle.
Thank you so much, Steve. Oh, gosh, it's great, really, that you were able to jump in there and to make a connection for us. It's great to have everybody on the call. And I'm looking forward to this one, especially. I mean, I think every month it's really an honor to be able to get together like this with each other, and also to have the caliber of people who are willing to join us on the call. Like last week, we had Farmer Brown, who is absolutely, as you all could tell, a fountain. I always call him a fountain of knowledge and understanding about what actually is going on in the animal agriculture business industry, both organic and non-organic. And we have Dr. Melanie Joy tonight, Colleen Patrick Goudreau next month. And we'll be having more exciting people, but I think you're the real exciting people. So thank you all for the work you're doing. I'd like to take a moment as we begin our time this evening just briefly to just center in consciousness, feel our connection with our own inner purpose, with this beautiful earth that we are so fortunate to be able to inhabit, spinning in outer space with 7 billion human beings and just an incredible celebration of life here. We give thanks for everyone who is doing their best to awaken to the truth that they are and to be a force for healing and for peace and for freedom, for justice, equality, sustainability. We give thanks for all of our loved ones and for the truth that there is an awakening happening in human consciousness, that we are part of it, and that it is growing. And it's really exciting to be part of this. So I want to thank all of you, and we just give thanks for this time we have, this very short time of a human life. You know, it seems kind of long when we're going through it, but one of the things I've noticed as my birthday is about 2 days away, I don't usually think of birthdays, but I'll be turning 58, and it's just really, it seems like I was just 18 a few days ago. The good thing is I'm finding I'm running around like I'm 18, so I think there's something to this plant-based eating. I just actually had a great opportunity. I'd love to recommend it to folks, anyone who feels so inclined, to get into nature. You know, I last Wednesday I went into the wilderness, San Jacinto Wilderness in Southern California, with my backpack and just walked up, you know, for quite a few hours, up and back, and finally ended up in a place where there were no human beings, and I was it was a beautiful place, really, in the forest, a very open forest like is in the western United States, with no understory, really, just these huge ponderosa pines, and then just open underneath them, a beautiful stream. And I was there until Sunday, so I was there for about 4.5 or 5 days, and I just listened the whole time. I didn't really do a lot of reading and writing. I did very little, actually, reading or writing, a little bit of writing the last day or two to kind of connect and cement. I wrote some meditations, which hopefully will be coming out as a CD in the next couple of months. But I think just taking time to listen in our own way, and to nature, and into our own inner feelings, and into our purpose on this planet, is incredibly important to keep from being washed away, and to have our sensibilities covered over and dulled. And it's very easy. We're constantly being bombarded with a lot of negativity. And it was just wonderful to be up there in a pristine natural environment with a beautiful stream and a swimming hole and really cold, clear water you could drink, and lots of little animals, squirrels and bluebirds and hummingbirds and chickadees and an owl, some mice. It was really great to feel the presence of this very active community. And I'm so glad that people have the foresight to set aside large areas where we can go in and be in solitude, or we can go in and just, there's no hunting or fishing allowed. There's really no we're not allowed, no humans are allowed to mess with things. And to use these resources that we have to refresh and replenish our spiritual and psychological and emotional bodies and energy, and take time to meditate and to reflect on this precious human life that we have, and to make sure that we're doing the best we can to use our time wisely, which I know all of you are. I really feel very honored again to be able to work together with you and to help spread this vegan message into the world. And so before Melanie, I talked to Melanie Joy, Dr. Melanie Joy, yesterday about the call, and she's going to be joining us a little tiny bit late, probably in about 10 minutes, because she had a few things she had to do. She's in Massachusetts and had a presentation. So for her, it's about 9:15 for me right now in California. It's 3 hours earlier. And so as soon as she calls in, I'll introduce her. But in the meantime, I wanted to go over a couple of things and also reiterate what Steve said, which is that if, as we're going along this evening, if you have any questions or comments, please press star 2 and we'll see it, and we'll unmute your phone and you can speak, or go ahead and type it in if you're on the computer, and we can look and see what the messages that you've typed in. And so it's been a great month, I think, in a lot of ways. There's been a lot of more and more discussion about our treatment of animals for food in the vegan community. We had the AR conference, which I did not attend this year. We had Vegetarian Summerfest, which is always pretty, I find it anyway, pretty inspiring because of the all the conversations and example of healthy, happy vegan people. And there's been, one of the big things, I guess, was this agreement between the Humane Society and United Egg Producers, which I discussed in the very first actual voice podcast that AR Zone has had. And I have that on the August resource sheet that you all have on your membership site. And so feel free to listen to that if you haven't already. I discuss what I think about that whole thing. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. But it's, I think, some great discussions I noticed that have been taking place, and questions in the forums lately. And I think this is, just fantastic. And I wanted to say a couple of things about Harold Brown's talk last month, just basically to underline the statement that he made, and it wasn't really a statement, it was a whole development of a theme that organic dairy has a lot of even in some ways more suffering than non-organic dairy, and non-organic dairy is really atrocious. And in fact, where I'm camping in Southern California right now is right next to a dairy, and I'm not sure if it's organic or not. It's kind of hard to tell the difference, but there's just these poor animals. I mean, I can see them over there, probably, you know, between 500 and 1,000, I would say, cows in the blazing sun. And it's hot, really, in Southern California, inland, and they are just eating, and that's basically all they can do. They have it better than some, I think, that are confined inside, but still, the smell, luckily the wind blows the other way, but the people on the other side are getting constantly inundated with a really toxic smell. But the animals themselves are really suffering, and what Harold Brown was talking about, since they don't use antibiotics and the use of this corkscrew to open up the udder, I mean, it must be so painful to have that done if one is a cow, to have that go in and then yank it out and try to ream out their the nipple, the teeth, so that the milk will flow, because mastitis causes the udders and the teeth to stop. To swell up and get infected. So, and that was just one of many things that I don't think anyone ever thinks of. I don't think the average person eating organic dairy could ever even imagine the array of suffering that these animals are forced to endure. He talked about a lot of other infections that cows are susceptible to when they're all living together in these unnatural conditions, like they do on organic dairies. So I want to really emphasize the importance of us doing as much research as we can, really, to find out what's going on and to spread the word however we can. I do notice that we have a hand up here. Pamela, I'll go ahead and unmute because I think, I don't know, we have this great contest. You're unmuted, Pamela.
Okay. Hey, happy birthday, Will.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I was the daughter of a dairy farmer. He was actually on the Mid-America Board of Dairymen Association, and I'm running this contest now. And I just really want to encourage everybody on the line to participate, because my intention is really to get it out there to mainstream. If people make a short little clip about the benefits they've received by getting off dairy, and then they push it out there to mainstream to get some votes on it, that's just really going to spread the word, I think, in a very organic way. And it's just veganmilkrevolution.com.
Wow. Well, yeah, thanks so much. Do you want to say anything more about it, or is that pretty much it?
Yeah, well, just a couple other things. I made two other video clips on how to make a video, because I'm finding that a lot of people are writing the emails like, yes, I've really benefited, and but they can't make a video. And so I made a video on how to make a video. And I think it really takes a lot of guts to put yourself out there and actually upload it on YouTube and just verbalize how you feel about it. And then also the second one right on that same site is on storytelling and how to add some humor. I think that's really key to help ourselves not get so stressed out about it. And then also to magnetize the listener so they want to listen to us.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Pamela. You know, I have to second what you just said, because I went on your the site. And by the way, I just will remind everybody that the link for this is on your August resources. That is one of the sheets, the documents that's in your membership site. So you can go, you can just click, it'll take you right to it. And Pamela has done a great job. There's three videos there, one that describes the contest, a second one that talks about how to make a video, which is really good, you know, because a lot of times we feel daunted about getting in front of a camera and putting ourselves in front of a bunch of people, but she talks about ways to do it that will make it easy. And then the third one I actually found very interesting, some tricks of storytelling and humor and having a humor journal. and bringing lightness and the human element to the videos that you make. And so it's a great teaching tool, as well as an opportunity to earn a prize and to spread the message of compassion for cows and other animals that are harmed. I mean, cows are, you know, eating a lot of fish. It's just a whole, as well as pigs and chickens and everything else. So it's a real, I think, a great opportunity, Pamela. So thanks so much for making that available.
Yes, and thank you. The Soya Bella is one of the prizes. There are 7 different prizes, and I just got a bunch of cookbooks from Vegetarian Resource Group. But the Soya Bella, I'm loving that because I don't have all those boxes from all the soy milk and all the coconut milk and everything. I can make my own milk. So thanks for that video and turning me on to the Soya Bella. They're great. They're sending one out to one of the winners, so...
Yeah.
Not only are you doing really good things to spread the word, but you might get some cool prizes, too. And I think it takes that first person to put a video up. I think really to get that first one up is going to be huge.
Right, right. Yeah, I think you're right. And the Soya Bella, if you have a chance, if you haven't already seen it, if you want to find out about a Soya Bella, you can just go to YouTube and put in Madeline, my wife, Madeline Tuttle, you know, put that in under the search, and you'll see her Soya Bella video that she made of how she makes nut milk, and it's really great. It's so inexpensive to make really delicious sunflower seed and pumpkin seed. You can throw in a few hazelnuts or almonds if you want. It's raw. It's organic. It's only, I think it's only like 40 cents for a quart or so. It's very inexpensive, and also you can make soy milk as well. If you'd like to do that, and you can make, and it's very quick and easy. So that's one of the prizes. So yay, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Will.
Good. All right. So let's see. What else do we have going on here? Okay. So I'll go through maybe here the a few other things that are on that resource sheet. Basically, you know, just when you have a chance to have a look at it, but there's the podcast that I gave from Vegetarian Summer Fest, which maybe if I have a chance, I'll talk about that a little bit later. Quite a nice talk by the famous Australian animal rights activist, Patty Marks. She's the one who invented something called Open Rescue, and it's been copied a lot in this country. It's been really one of the, I think, a great tactic where people go into a place like very often where there are chickens, hens in battery cages, and will just go in and just rescue some of them and not try to defend themselves, and you know, maybe be arrested, and then do it as publicity, take video of everything, of course, and just show the public what's happening. And so she's very, it's a good talk. And then there's some, I just want to always emphasize this Veg E-News. There's a lot of great articles and keeps you, very good resource to keep up to date with what's going on in the world of veganism and animal rights advocacy. And there's an article also by Peter Singer, which isn't very long, but it's a very good one, I think. It's just about the incredible amount of violence towards fish, and in there, for the first time, we have a new estimate of how many fish are killed every year in the world, because we don't keep track of them by numbers, we keep track of them simply by tonnage, and the numbers are higher than most people ever thought. Estimates are between 1 and 2.7 trillion fish per year are being killed by humans for food, which is you know, inconceivable, really, but the amount of violence towards fish. And I just watched a video. I bought it. You can get it on Amazon. It's called End of the Line, and I recommend it. It's End of the Line. It shows you, it's a very good documentary about how the fishing fleet in the world has grown grown and grown, and it's just way over capacity. I mean, there's way too many fishing boats and ships out there for the number of fish that are left. And so the fish really don't have a chance. And the fisheries are collapsing everywhere. There's really nowhere where they're not just being completely devastated by the overcapacity. And they talk quite a bit about tuna and the illegal catching of tuna, and also the efforts to try to regulate the fishermen, the fishing industry, which is very difficult to do because you have a lot of people who will poach, of course. So I found that it was a very good video to understand the overfishing situation. It's pretty recent. However, I will say it's a very frustrating movie to watch because never once does anyone mention eating less fish or going vegan or going vegetarian even. All they talk about is eating fish that are sustainable and setting aside refuges for the fish where they won't be destroyed and where they can reproduce so that we can keep eating them, but not eat perhaps quite so many. So I found it was very deceitful, the movie. It was very, dishonest in its solutions that it proposed, and didn't talk at all about the fact that about half the fish are being fed to livestock for dairy and meat production and other fish. And they talked a little tiny bit about factory farm fishing too, but it was very, very much made by fish eaters for fish eaters. And but still, nevertheless, that's some good information. So that my movie review of End of the Line. And then there's this link on veganism, a video that was inspired by the World Peace Diet, and I really enjoyed it. It's very uplifting. It has a lot of nice images of animals, and then a lot of quotes from the World Peace Diet. And then there's Melanie Joy's article, which I hope you have all had a chance to read. If not, then it's there for you. You can read it. It's called Understanding Neocarnism, How Vegan Advocates Can Appreciate and Respond to Happy Meat, Locavorism, and Paleo Dieting. And it looks to me like we've got Melanie Joy here online. So I'll go ahead and introduce her, and then we can come back later to some of the other ideas I wasn't able to finish up, because we're really honored to have Dr. Melanie Joy with us. She is the author, as Steve said at the beginning, of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, An Introduction to Carnism. She is a professor of psychology and sociology at UMass Boston and has written a number of articles on psychology and animal protection and social justice, and is the leading researcher on carnism, which is a word that she has, I think, coined herself, which I think is great, and has presented for quite a few radio and television networks, as well as conferences. And we have crossed paths over the years a few times, and it's always really delightful to me personally to be able to talk to Melanie Joy, because I think she is a great embodiment of someone who's done some deep thinking about our culture's mistreatment of animals for food and is working hard to formulate ways that we can help people to awaken to the underlying driving forces of their violence and therefore be able to stop it. So, Melanie, welcome to our call.
Hi, thank you so much, Will. It's an honor. It really is.
Yeah, well, good. Can you, I guess everyone can hear you. I can hear you, so I'm assuming we're good to go here. And so I'm in California. You're in Boston, and I know that you're going to be flying out here in the next day or two to do some lectures out here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I think also in Southern California. And we're going to be crisscrossing our paths, which is, to me, great. And exciting. And so I'd like to go ahead and just jump right in here. I think the people who are on the call are somewhat familiar with your work, but I still think it would be great maybe to hear a little bit about it. So can you just explain to us, what is carnism?
Sure, sure. In a nutshell, carnism is the word that I use to describe the invisible belief system or ideology that conditions people to eat certain animals. It's essentially the opposite of veganism. You know, we tend to only name those belief systems or ideologies that run counter to the dominant system, but and we leave the dominant system unnamed. And when we don't name it, we can't talk about it. It's like there are vegans and vegetarians, and then there's everybody else. And so I felt that it was really important to name the system so that we could, you know, not have this assumption that it's only vegans and vegetarians who bring their beliefs to the dinner table. You know, because most people in the U.S., for example, don't eat pigs but not dogs because they don't have a belief system when it comes to eating animals.
Right. Wow. I understand. Thanks. Yeah. And how does how do you think that we best approach this situation of carnism? I mean, how, you know, because I know you've thought a lot about this. But so we see, we've named it this invisible belief system. Then what?
Yeah, that's a great question, the million-dollar question. You know, I would say that we approach it the same way we approach other oppressive isms like racism and sexism. You know, we put the spotlight on it. We understand. It's really important for vegans to understand the very system they're working to transform. So to understand the way the system functions, the way that it is structured in society, and the way that it influences people, all of us, who are born into this system, because individuals internalize this mentality, the mentality of meat. So, you know, one thing that's really important to keep in mind is that carnism, like other isms that are based on violence or oppression, the teachings of carnism really run counter to core human values. You know, for most people care about animals and don't want them to suffer, and yet most people eat animals. So violent systems, violent ideologies like carnism need to use a set of defense mechanisms on a social level and on a psychological level to condition people, you know, to enable humane people to participate in inhumane practices without realizing what they're doing. And in my book and in my writing and speaking, I talk about all of these specific defenses and how they're carried out on a social level and on an individual level, because once we recognize the defenses, we're in a much better position to challenge them. If we don't understand carnism the way it's structured and embodied and embraced in society, in the institutions and in the people, you know, then it's like we're, you know, fighting against an invisible enemy, so to speak. And I don't really like to use the frame of enemy making, but it's like the system that we're working to transform is invisible to us, and we really need to see it.
Wow, that's really well said. You know, this invisible system. Listen, I wonder, you know, I just got a note from Steve, who's kind of the technical side of things, and the line that you're on is kind of clicking, and I was wondering, could you maybe just hang up and call back, and either on the same phone or if you have a different line handy or cell phone or something, because it's a little bit interfering, I think, with people perhaps.
Okay.
Getting the full benefit of what you're saying. I mean, you can hear it. It's not that serious,
okay.
But he thinks it would be good. So, and I'll go ahead and talk a little bit and carry forward.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try to call from my cell phone. This is a landline, so I'll do that right now.
Okay.
All right. Bye bye.
Great. Thanks. Yeah. Bye. Yeah. So, I think that what he is on to here is it's nothing that is different from what we are talking about in the World Peace Diet. It's it adds a word for what I refer to as the mentality that allows us to kill and eat 75 million animals every single day. And I talk about it, as you all know, I'm sure, as mentality of commodification, reductionism, elitism, privilege, and exclusion, and domination of the feminine, and so forth. So I see it more in terms of how it actually functions. But I think the beneficial point that Melanie has made in her book is that to name it sort of takes away this capacity that people have to think that they're just normal. You know, there's this idea, I think it's very helpful when someone says, oh, yeah, you're a vegan, you know, and now we can say, well, yeah, and you're a carnist. What do you mean? What's a carnist? Well, a carnist is someone who believes that animals are put here for us to use and we can just harm them however we want, and violence toward them is okay. And suddenly their belief system has been labeled, and I think that that is very healthy. So I think we've got go ahead, Steve, sorry. We've got Melanie back. Are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me okay now?
Oh, this is better, I think. Yeah,
okay.
This is better.
Interesting. This is a cell phone, and the other one was a landline. So whatever works.
I know. Right, exactly. Great. All right. So, yeah, so I was just kind of summarizing a little bit the some of what you were saying and the power of naming something. Suddenly it's not this it doesn't have the power over us, I think, that it has when it's not named. So I'm really grateful that you came up with that word. And can you say a little bit more, perhaps, about it in terms of what really seems to be going on a lot now, and you write about it in your article, the neocarnism, you know, maybe how carnism, which I think people understand. And by the way, everybody, if you want to have a question for Melanie here, feel free to press star 2 if you have a question about carnism or any of this. So, but anyway, neocarnism is, this idea, I think we see it all the time of, well, I don't eat meat. I mean, I eat meat, but it's healthy. It's happy meat. It's organic. It was humane certified and so forth. And it's local or whatever. So I think it's really interesting for us as we're attempting to be effective vegan advocates to understand perhaps what's underlying some of these, the appeal of these arguments. And can you shed some light on that?
Absolutely. I also want to say one thing. I think it's important to recognize that carnists are, you know, people who eat animals are typically inadvertent carnists because they don't even know that there is a system guiding their choices like an invisible hand. And so, you know, for most people to tell somebody that you have a belief system, that you believe it's okay to do this and that's why you do this, most people won't get that. They won't make that connection because the belief system is invisible. And so one frame that I find very useful is to view carnists, and I use the term carnist with vegans but not with carnists because it's very triggering for them because they don't even realize that they're following the dictates of a belief system, but to really view them as victims of this system that victimizes all of us in different ways. Obviously, the animals are the most direct and obvious victims, but, you know, also those of us who grew up in this system and who were, you know, so deeply influenced by its invisible hand that we ended up acting against our own interests and our own core values.
So the idea is to see that, yeah, that you don't blame them for this. You see them as victims of that programming.
Exactly. It's not, I mean, I think for vegans, one thing that's really important, you know, that can be very helpful for vegans and carnists alike is to recognize that eating animals is not simply a matter of individual ethics. It's the inevitable end result of a deeply entrenched belief system. And it helps us to appreciate how, you know, basically good people can do things that are destructive, can participate in these destructive practices. You know, eating animals is such a deeply ingrained behavior that asking somebody to stop doing that is not just asking for a shift, for a change of behavior. It's asking for a shift of consciousness. And that kind of shift of consciousness doesn't come until a person's ready for it to come. So, you know, getting back to your question about neocarnism, I had just wanted to respond to something I heard you talking about while I was just coming on the line. But neocarnism is the term that I use to describe these three new, I guess you could say, strains of carnism, new versions of the ideology. In my work, I talk about what I refer to as the three ends of justification. Have you talked about this, Will, or so I don't want to reiterate it?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Tell us about the three ends. Yeah, go ahead.
The three ends of justification, I talked about how carnism is, you know, a system that's structured, uses these defense mechanisms. And so one of its defenses is justification, and it uses what I call the three ends of justification to maintain itself. Eating animals is normal, natural, and necessary. And these same ends have been used to support violent ideologies throughout human history, from slavery to, you know, male dominance. And what that implies is that not eating animals is abnormal, unnatural, and unnecessary. It's a way of dismissing veganism and the vegan message. What I believe has happened, however, is that because the primary defense of carnism, which is denial, denying there's a problem in the first place, if we deny there's a problem in the first place, we don't have to do anything about it. Because the primary defense, denial, that's expressed through invisibility, keeping it hidden, has been sufficiently weakened, carnism has begun to rely more on justifications than it did before, thanks to, in my opinion, you know, the great work of many, many vegan activists and animal protection organizations. There is much more awareness today about the reality of animal agriculture than there has been in a very long time, if ever, since factory farming, certainly. There's more awareness now than ever. And people are really starting to question. And so what's happened is that carnism now needs to rely on its sort of secondary or second-tier defense, which is the three ends of justification. So each one of these ends, normal, natural, and necessary, has kind of morphed into its own ideology. So, for instance, when we say eating animals is normal, you know, that's what I refer to as, you know, compassionate carnism. It's the argument is that, you know, people don't want to step too far outside the carnistic norm. They don't want to be too different. They want to keep eating animals. They see veganism as extreme and radical. And so, therefore, they want to take the more moderate stance and say, well, we're not going to stop eating animals, but we'll eat animals that have been treated well, if that makes any sense. And there's been this whole kind of ideology that's been constructed around that. Now, sometimes compassionate carnism is, in fact, a step on the way to veganism, and that's a good thing. But more often than not, or at least often enough, it ends up becoming a justification to keep eating animals and not move any closer to carnism.
Right.
Eating animals as natural is what I refer to as eco-carnism, which is like the Michael Pollans, the sustainability people. You know, they say, well, you know, vegans are, veganism is a movement of urbanites and suburbanites who are, you know, these upper middle class people who have just lost touch with the source of their food. You know, they really advocate getting up close and personal, you know, hunting, for instance, or supporting small family farms where people are not using invisibility. They're saying, hey, you know, we see what happens to the animals. This is natural. This is the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
You know, but what they're actually doing is they're using that as a justification. They're not recognizing that, you know, becoming more connected with your food doesn't necessarily mean killing somebody. It might mean becoming more connected with the animal so that you don't want to kill them.
Right.
And then the third one that you had mentioned, the paleo dieters, I call that biocarnism. And those are, you know, that's the end, eating animals is necessary. And those are often the, you know, former, not always, but often former vegans and vegetarians who said, we got sick on this diet, it didn't work for us, and they just kind of throw all caution to the wind. And, you know, the whole conversation about veganism goes out the window because the assumption is it's impossible to be healthy and vegan.
Right. Have you read, or I'm just wondering how many people, I haven't read myself, I haven't been able to bring myself to do a Lee Ortiz book. She's, it comes to mind when you say, you know what I'm talking about, the vegetarian myth?
Oh, that. You know what, I couldn't actually finish it. I have read
some
of it. It was tough, but she's, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, the vegetarian myth, it's just so interesting that, you know, that phrase should even be used. You know, it's one of the ends of justification. She's really challenging our challenge of the myths of meat. I mean, one of the things that I say in my article is that, you know, vegans understandably despair and they say, oh, despite all of our efforts, we've got people now eating happy meat. And people now eating sustainable meat, you know, what have we done wrong? And I say it's not because it's not despite our efforts, it's because of them. This is a backlash. You know, it's because vegan advocates have been so successful of raising awareness about the issue that it's now in the public discourse. And this is a backlash. This is a reaction against the vegan message. This is what you expect when a social movement gains power.
Mm. So it's actually a sign of our success that people are being pushed to develop these new defenses. And
Exactly. Instead
of despairing, we can still despair if we want to, but we can also think, okay, now we – so how do you propose we address these three, these types of things?
Well, I think it's really important to recognize them for what they are. I mean, one of the ways that carnism and the neo-carnisms maintain themselves is by presenting themselves as though they're objective truths rather than subjective ideologies. You know, people often
right.
say, oh, you're vegan, you've got a bias. You know, well, no, you're a neo-carnist and you have a bias. So it's really important to recognize them for what they are and not take them at face value as rational arguments, because if you deconstruct them, if you actually peel the onion away, you'll find that they are all irrational. There is, if people truly believe that animals have feelings and animals have lives that matter to them, people truly believe that animals can suffer and do not support gratuitous or unnecessary violence to other sentient beings, then there is no rationale, there's no justification for causing harm to other animals, there's no justification for eating them, because all of these carnisms, these neo-carnisms exist to support those who do not need to eat meat in order to survive, or animals in order to survive. We're not talking about tribal cultures here, we're talking about the United States. So I think, you know,
right.
one thing is to really recognize them for what they are, and also to appreciate that many people who are proponents of neo-carnisms are people who have become proponents of neo-carnisms because those are the people who actually are more concerned about their impact on the world. You know, they may not be making the perfect choice. They may not be making the right choice in some ways, but at least they're reflecting on the ethics of their choices, and they're asking, how can I do less harm? And I think that's a really good place to start. So when we're advocating, when we're talking to them, rather than see them as the enemy and see them as just people, excusitarians, you know, to see them as people who, you know, are struggling, they're grappling with complex choices in a complicated system, and to encourage them to continue to reflect on their choices and challenge them, but in a compassionate way.
Right. Yeah, we talk a lot about that in the World Peace Diet facilitative training. I talk about it somewhat in the World Peace Diet too. That people who are perpetrators of violence are also the victims. They are only doing it because they have been harmed themselves. And I think growing up in our culture, being forced as little children to eat the flesh and secretions of animals that have been horribly treated. And, you know, we don't just watch people doing it. We have to do it ourselves. We have to actually eat that flesh and eat that cheese and drink that milk. And we don't, it's just portrayed as something, as you say, normal, natural, necessary. But actually, if we really looked at it, I think there is something very horrifying about that for us as human beings. And so we have to shut down. And what we as vegans are basically doing is inviting people who are still eating animal foods to reflect on why they're doing it. And so it gets very, very, you know, everybody takes it in a different way, but I think the most effective way we can do it is to plant seeds. You know, that's the phrase I use a lot. That I can't actually perhaps change someone directly, but I can plant seeds and do it in either more skillfully, perhaps, or less skillfully. And I think there's this interesting question that comes up, which is, okay, so you know, we plant our seeds, we make our points, we speak, we are examples of another way of living. We listen to people when they tell us about why they're eating animal foods, that they're doing it because they're not treated so badly now. The food that they're buying comes from Whole Foods. It's not just the normal McDonald's. They pay twice as much and get it at Whole Foods. And but I think it's important for us not to let them off the hook also, and to confront people with the fact that, for example, if they were to be these people who are now so almost venerated, you know, you have Neiman Ranch and these other places where they're sort of venerated as being compassionate and sustainable people. meat producers, if they were doing the same thing that they're doing to cows and to sheep, to dogs and to cats and horses or something, they'd all be thrown in jail and be spat upon, you know. So it's you know, I think just making that point is really helpful, I think, to help people. And I think that's one of the reasons you probably would agree to that, I would imagine. And what do you think, though, can you say anything about something you said a little earlier, which is people change when they're ready, when they're ripe, in a sense, when they're ripe to change? Do you have any thoughts about what brings that ripening about?
That's the million-dollar question. I've talked to so many graduate students about how to research this and actually get some empirical data on, you know, what exactly, you know, encourages people to make this change, you know, to stop eating animals. But, you know, one thing that is clear is that people change no matter what we're talking about. You know, people do all sorts of things that are self-destructive and other destructive, and they do them until they're ready to stop doing them. People smoke and they drink and they make bad relationship choices, or at least destructive relationship choices. And so I think if we see eating animals as something similar, in fact, even, you know, more difficult to change in some ways, because eating animals is, it's not just about a behavior. It's about a whole a belief system. It's symbolic. There's a whole identity that people have around eating animals. And, you know, what we can do, as you pointed out, is to plant seeds. But in general, people don't change until they feel safe enough to change. And that means, you know, feel safe psychologically, feel safe socially, feel safe practically and physically. So, you know, for instance, when we ask somebody to stop eating animals, we're asking them to, you know, see themselves as a strand in the web of life rather than standing atop the so-called hierarchical ladder of life. We're asking them to, you know, become possibly ostracized, to become part of a minority, to become, you know, to risk being teased, to be perceived differently, to risk important relationships. I mean, I don't think relationships have to end when one person becomes vegan, but I've seen that happen. You know,
right.
I've seen it put a strain on people's lives and their relationships. So, you know, I talked to this woman once, which is a great example, and she was, you know, probably in her early 50s and or maybe late 40s, and, you know, she said, I have a husband, I've got kids, I'm completely on board with the vegan message, what can I do? I mean, she did have choices. She could have changed. You know, she could have stopped eating animals. But she was really afraid that to stop eating animals meant that she would have to deal with a certain level of conflict in her family that she didn't feel like she could withstand. So I think that it's important for people to recognize that it's not so black and white when we're advocating veganism, and that, as you point out, we need to plant seeds.
Right. Great. I have a question that has come in from somebody. And it is, I'll just read it. Hi, Melanie. Great to hear you on the show. Regarding your comment that people are inadvertent carnists, how, in psychological terms, do you view those who can see films like Earthlings and gain great awareness of animal cruelty and still be untouched by the suffering that is imposed on animals and still eat animals? How do we understand the mentality operating here?
That is such a great question. It really is. And, I mean, I talked to so many vegans, and myself many years ago, just exasperated and say, how on earth can you watch this and go back to eating animals? And, you know, what really it comes down to is that people will, chances are people will not be motivated to change based on knowledge alone. You know, knowledge lays the groundwork for change, but feeling inspires action. I mean, advertisers, marketers know this. People make decisions based on their feelings, not on logic, more often than not. So people can watch these films, and they may be taking the information in on a head level, intellectually, but until they integrate that and allow it into their hearts and allow themselves to actually feel it, it's not going to impact them in the same way it impacts somebody who has truly witnessed it. I mean, because when we're talking about awareness, we're talking about two levels of awareness. There's intellectual awareness and there's emotional awareness. And both of those components need to be in place at least to some degree. So, you know, people use psychic numbing, you know, just numbing themselves psychologically to the truth of their experience. All the time, we all do. A surgeon has to psychically numb herself or himself in order to perform surgery. I mean, there's no way they could do open-heart surgery on someone unless they shut down their emotions while they were in there. that's adaptive numbing. It's you know, kind of keeping them psychologically safe so they can do their job. The same kind of psychological process is in place when people sit in front of a film like Earthlings and shut down their emotions. So they take it in on a head level and they block their emotions. I don't think that that's necessarily adaptive, because they're using it to enable violence. But it's a self-protection. It's a defense mechanism that people use when they don't feel like they can let that in.
Sure. Right. I know it happens a lot in slaughterhouse workers and, you know, just in general, people do horrible things and they just learn to just not feel and not connect and not think. Butchers, you know, are well known to have to, for doing that as well. And once we make the feeling and once we let it in and make the connection, then you see people really changing. I think that's
right. That's right. And
exactly
people
it.
And if you're a person that's naturally more of a feeling person, or you're more open, or you're more empathic, when you watch something like Earthlings, you're watching it, you're taking in the information intellectually and emotionally simultaneously, but not everybody is having that same experience.
Right. Yep. And that's a, excellent question. One other thing here, somebody else has asked about the new welfareism. If the new welfareism that we see happening in the animal rights or animal protection movement, how you see that relating to neocarnism and carnism. Can you make any statements about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on how you define new welfareism. You know, people have different ways of interpreting that. I'm assuming that this person is referring to not necessarily a movement, but animal welfare campaigns that are advocating for, you know, cage-free eggs, for instance.
Bigger cages, and right, yeah, all those things, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how do I see it playing in? I mean, it's complicated because, you know, welfare initiatives I think that the welfare initiatives that have been run by the larger animal protection organizations, I mean, they clearly have been one of the reasons that invisibility, you know, the primary defense of the carnistic system, invisibility and denial have been so destabilized. And so, you know, the question is, I think the person may be asking, are we giving people another excuse, another reason to eat animals? Are we feeding a justification for eating animals by carrying out these welfare campaigns? And the answer is complex, and I don't think there's no empirical data that we have in the United States to determine, you know, whether when it comes to human meat consumption, the impact that these have on the animals. But we do know that there's a big difference between I just heard Bruce Friedrich talk at AR. There's a big difference between somebody being in a cage where they can't turn around their entire life and somebody being able to walk around on the ground. I think from the animal's perspective, obviously, at least in the immediate, right now, there's a difference for them. How does it affect the psyche of the consumer? I don't have the answer to that. You know, my guess is that it destabilizes invisibility, which is a good thing. And if campaigns are not carefully crafted, they may be used, co-opted by industry, animal agribusiness, as a way to reinforce one of the ends.
Right, yeah. Yes, I think I can definitely see your point. Thank you for tackling that one. That's kind of a tough question. Right? I mean, it's kind of a charged question. Yeah.
Well,
I can't do it justice
in this short a period of time. It's a very complex question.
Right, and there's very strong feelings on both sides of all these things, too. But great. Well, I think this has been very interesting. I'm wondering now, does anyone else have any questions for Melanie Joy while we have a chance? Press star 2 if you would like to ask a question, make a comment, or find out anything more from her. Or if you're at your computer, go ahead and type it in, because we're running to the limit of our time here for this part of the call. It's been really interesting. It's been, I think, a great contribution to the work that we're doing to understand this perspective. I think it's really helpful. So I don't see any other questions coming in. Thank you for those questions that we did get. And, I got one here. Okay, here's a question. You are now unmuted.
Good evening.
Hey, hi. It sounds like Grace. Hi, Grace.
Yay, good evening, Will. And Melanie, thank you so much. Thank you so much for this call. My phone's disconnected a couple times, but I keep calling back in.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi. I don't know if you remember, we met at the World Peace Yoga Jubilee, and I got a copy of your book. I wanted to let you know that I passed that along to a beautiful young lady. She's in high school in Palm Springs, and we're trying to get some vegan school lunch options at her Palm Springs High School. I sent the book to her, and although you had signed it to me, thanks for being a witness, and I signed it to her, thanks for being a witness. She said that it's very, very helpful, and in fact, her older sister has stolen it, so she didn't get to finish it.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you, and thank you for your work on school lunches. That's such an important initiative to be working on, so it's good to hear your voice, and I appreciate that.
Awesome. Can you remind me, you have an awesome website, don't you? Like Carnism, or Angie Adolph. Angie said she didn't get to the last little bit of it, and I thought I could post your website to her Facebook page if you would remind me what it is.
Absolutely. It's carnism.com, and I have resources there for vegans, how to talk about issues and how to relate to carnists and frequently asked questions, responses to them. So,
awesome.
Great.
Thank you so much, carnism.com. Have a wonderful evening.
Okay. Thanks. You too.
Great. So I guess, Melanie, we're kind of getting, kind of wrapping it up here. Thanks so much for joining us. Is there anything more you'd like to just say in conclusion to everybody who is on the call? We have people who are really working hard in their communities and with the people around them to be effective advocates for compassion and health and respect for all life. I just wanted to give you one last chance if you have anything else you wanted to say to everybody.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to thank you, Will, and everybody on the call, just for the work that you're doing in this world. You're all the ambassadors ushering in this new era of awakening and awareness, and it's really very challenging to be in this world and to see the reality of what happens to the animals and the violence around us, and to be able to have the courage to keep your eyes open and bear witness to that truth and hold on to your own truth and live your truth every day and actively work to transform the world to become a place of greater compassion is just, there's nothing better than that. So I just want to express my appreciation.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Melanie Joy, and I encourage everyone to look at the work that she's doing, the books and the book and the articles and everything. And if you have a chance to hear her speak, she's been speaking quite a bit at Unitarian churches now. Apparently, right? You have all
That's
over
right.
Different areas in the United States here and there. So check and see if she's coming to an area near you. You can hear her speak.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, it'll all be posted on Twitter, on carnism.com Twitter, and on my Facebook page. So thank you, Will. Have a wonderful
great.
Evening.
All right. Thanks so much. Talk to you later.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. Great. Well, thank you, Melanie. She's really a wonderful person. And I think that, it needs all of us to bring our perspective. I think each one of us, honestly, has a unique perspective that we bring to the work of helping animals and helping to spread the message of compassion for animals. And I noticed there's someone on the line that I would like to hear a little bit from if she's ready, my friend and colleague Lily. She's been on this call one other time. I think it was a few months ago. She lives up in Northern California, way, way up, kind of in the wilderness. But I always think it's nice to hear from Lily and to hear a little bit about what she's doing to help spread the message of the World Peace Diet. And so I'm wondering, Lily, are you with us on the call?
I am. Did you unmute me, or do I unmute myself?
You are being heard by everyone right now.
Oh, I am being heard. Okay, great.
Yep.
Oh, you make me laugh. I'm in the wilderness. Oh, I'm just so grateful. You know, I had no intention of becoming a vegan when I moved to this paradise that I live in, and I wasn't a vegan. And then 5 years ago, the World Peace Diet came into my life. And within the first chapter, I turned to my husband while I was chopping some vegetables for a salad, and I said, "We're vegans, aren't we?" And he looked at me, and he said, "We're vegans." And it's been such a wonderful adventure. I'm so grateful. There's so much gratitude, and there's peace in my home today that I can't even, it's palpable. It's so beautiful. And my animals, again, they're all... I found a pet formula called Evolution Diet that my animals are thriving. I have cats and dogs. And, in fact, I'm just going to share with you how I answer my phone. I keep this message going, and actually what I do is I screen my calls because I want people to hear this message, because for me, every morning is a morning to carry the message of the World Peace Diet. And I'm out in the street right now in town. I'm calling from town. Just a moment. I'm going to roll up the windows to my car so that... Here. Okay, I'm going to give you my message. And this is very interesting, what happens out of this message itself. And this is how you will... this is the message you'll find when you reach my home. You have reached the vegan home of Jim and Lily and various other beings... A sanctuary for the World Peace Diet. To find out more, go to worldpeacediet.org. Thank you. And I get all kinds of responses for this. The other day someone called, and it was a person that works up here in Humboldt County in the sanitation field, and he said, "You win for the most intriguing message I have ever heard." And I'm going to be meeting with him because I'm taking some chemicals off of my property to that area to be recycled, and I'm going to, and I don't use these kinds of things anymore too. I mean, the whole vegan message is so full of peace and beauty. The insects have become my friends, and there are plenty of them on my property, but I have these little postcards that Will sent me, and I hand those out at every opportunity. And I do live out in nature. I've been so blessed to live out in nature. But being a vegan has actually made me one with nature. There was always some kind of a war going on before, and especially with the insects. And now I can just look at them, and I see them as beings that are fellow, they're on a journey, just like I am. And there's no difference in the forest, and it's so... It's like what Will says at the end of his book about the celebrational atmosphere of nature, could be of nature. And I've always loved nature. I've hiked in the mountains, you know, 2,000 miles in the Sierras by foot. I've done that as my pastime and loved it. But never have I felt closer to nature than I do today, and closer to other beings, other human beings, whether or not they're vegan. And I just want to thank you so much, Will, for this marvelous presentation today. Dr.
Yeah.
Joy, what,
right.
Just
yeah.
Absolutely marvelous, absolutely marvelous. You wanted me to say more things about what I do. Well, every day I try, you know, if a person gets... the wrong number. I mean, I'm it. I live the World Peace Diet moment by moment by moment. And I've mentioned this before, I am in a 12-step program for food addiction of all things. And so these people are the right
people to reach, because we understand the dynamic of spirituality and food, that overeating tends to be a spiritual sickness. Well, eating our fellow beings is also a spiritual sickness. And I talk to people all over the world now, because all I say, because you don't go into other issues in a 12-step program, but I'd go on this phone bridge and I just say, I am a vegan and I sponsor vegans. And if anyone wants to hear about that, give me a call. And I put out my number and I get calls daily. And, you know, it's just a little bit that I do. It's just a little bit that I do every day. I just live it. I really ought to document it, because it feels like I do so little, and yet at the end of the day, I've done a lot. And that's it. Just fit it in, fit it in, fit it in here, fit it in there. I live it today. And I am particularly enamorate of the World Peace Diet, because it was that book, and I had read many others prior to and since, and they're all excellent, but that one book got to the heart and soul of my life and my husband's life, and we became vegan. It was as easy as off a log, of a slippery log. And I've dropped off of many of those when I've crossed streams in the High Sierra. So anyway, I'm not going to go on, but I just want to say that if you're a vegan and you're living it, I'm sure that you're just doing exactly what I'm doing, just putting it out there any way you can. And who knew? I didn't know. I hadn't planned. This was not on my game plan. And it's one of the most wonderful transformations that has ever happened to me. I've had a few, because I've been on a spiritual quest. And this has just enhanced everything I've ever done in my life.
Well, thank you so much. Lily. I'll let everybody know also that, you know, you've got this background in working with people in 12-step programs and helping to spread the vegan message, just by that yearning to help people with these kind of issues. And if anyone would like to get in touch with you, I'll let them have your number, because I know you don't use the internet. You're way out there in hinterlands beyond all that.
Oh, I know, and I feel bad about that, because every time I hear about what you're all doing, I feel like I've hobbled myself, and I'm going to have to wind up getting that going.
No worries. But great.
Thank you, Will. Thank you. It's such a privilege. It is a privilege and an honor to be involved in this incredible movement. And it gives me hope. It actually is the first thing that's ever given me hope for the planet at all, because I was so negative before. And I, you know, oh, by the way, 12-step is a program of attraction, not promotion. And that's how I feel about my vegan walk. It is attraction, and I do attract people to it, because people see me and they say, well, God, you look wonderful. And, you know, I work my way around, you know, to tell them why. And I always have a big smile on my face. I cry a lot every time I read just any section of your book, Will, which I do every morning before I start my morning meditation. I weep. I cry. I do cry, and I get that crying out, because my heart is totally broken by what is being done on this beautiful planet. But when I'm out there in the world, I put on a happy face, because I am so happy to be a vegan. So happy.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Lily, for just sharing these words and ideas and gems with us. I really appreciate it. Very beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Yeah. Wow. So this has been quite a call already, with all these beautiful words and ideas. And I really feel very touched by everything that's been happening here on the call. Also, there's someone else on the call. I know. I want to mention that we have two calls per month now. We're starting for the very first time in September. It's just right around the corner. I thought about this and talked to Steve about it, and we decided it would be a good idea. So, besides our call, that's the third Thursday of every month, which has a speaker, typically, like we just had Dr. Melanie Joy with us, on the first Tuesday, which will be September 6th coming up. We'll have a more informal time because we just run out of time here on these calls. It's so nice to hear the news and to talk these ideas, but I really want to make sure that we also have time for more in just a more casual atmosphere where people can just share their feelings and ask questions, respond to questions, and so forth. So. Mark that on your calendars. We'll remind you, too, but on Tuesday, September 6th, we'll have another call. And then, again, on September 20th, let's see here. I don't want to say it wrong like I did last time. September 15th will be the third Thursday with Colleen Patrick Boudreau, which should be amazing. She's really amazing. In fact, her book launch in San Francisco is going to be on August 21st, which actually is, ironically, my birthday. And she's birthing her book at the Millennium Restaurant, and it's a 30-day vegan challenge, which she says is a great book to give people if they want to be supported in going vegan. So it's great to see these resources emerging, it's fantastic, I think, to see everything snowballing here. And I want to also give a chance to Mark Stroud to say a few words again, because things are always developing in Mark's world, and new things are happening. And Mark is such a powerful advocate for compassion for animals and for health, and is really the initiator in many ways of the not only the conference that is held every year now in Cincinnati. It's called the Jubilee, the World Peace and Yoga Jubilee. But he was really did the first World Peace Diet study group in Cincinnati back in, I guess it was way back in 2006, I think, when the first book first came out. So, Mark, you are unmuted, and I'd just like to welcome you to say a few words to everybody, if you would like to.
Hello, Will.
Hi, Mark.
Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone else on the call. Hello, Steve. Great to hear Melanie. She was a wonderful presenter at Jubilee last year. So it's great to hear her again. Thank you, Melanie, for all the great work that you do. And, I'd like to maybe make a few announcements. The World Peace Yoga Center and the World Peace Diet Center in Healdsburg is operating, and we're going to have our first potluck this coming Monday, and vegan potluck and study group, and Will will be the featured speaker, so it's going to be great to have Will back in Healdsburg and speaking at the yoga center. So anybody in the Northern California area around Santa Rosa that would like to come to the potluck and bring a vegan dish and hear Will speak, that's coming up on the 22nd, next Monday. And you can find out more about that at worldpeaceyoga.com. And, of course, at on Will's website as well. That'll be a historic talk at the studio the very first time, right next to Cafe Gratitude.
Right, which is a
and
vegan
then
restaurant.
We've got vegan restaurant, yeah. And then we've got, of course, the Jubilee, the World Peace and Yoga Jubilee is coming up in October. And the facilitator training, World Peace Diet Facilitator Training with Will and Madeline, opportunity to be there with them for 4 days. We call it 4 days of oneness. It's a real opportunity to experience what that oneness is with all beings, all life. It's interesting because we talk about it as 4 days of peace, yoga, food and music. And a group of us from Cincinnati, I think about 24 of us, just came back from Woodstock, New York. And we were there at Wild Woodstock, which for a Jiva Mukti yoga retreat. And Jiva Mukti is a real sister organization because in their yoga practice, they teach vegan activism. It's part of their teacher training, and it's one of the five tenets. So it's always taught in the yoga practice. There's always a reference to veganism and activism, animal protection. So we went there to collaborate and to join with them, and it was really powerful. And of course, being in Woodstock, that always comes up. What happened back in the 60s, actually in 1969. And so we had our local study group this past Monday, Vegan Potluck, and Anna Ferguson asked me to speak since I was 17 at that time, so I was a child of the 60s. And one of the questions she asked was, what's different now than in the 60s? And what I talked about was that it seems to me that there was a lot of potential then. There was a lot of potential at Woodstock. But what I realized is that most of the people that I knew then that were activists, people that marched for peace, and of course anti-Vietnam march were real big then. I was participating in an anti-Vietnam march in 1967 in New York City, where there were over a million people. It's still considered to be one of, if not the largest, marches that ever in history on the planet. But what I realized is that almost none of the people that I knew back then that were marching and that were anti-Vietnam activists, none of them were vegan then. I was the only one that was. And I was just becoming a vegan when I was 17. But none of them are vegans today. And yet when I looked around the room at our study group, and we've got people coming to the study group from 12 years old to 80 years old, when I look around the room now, I see vegan activists, people who really, really are embodying and living the peace movement. They're not out necessarily out in the streets marching and carrying signs and so forth and so on, but they're really living it. They're really living a life of compassion and empathy. So that's the significant difference that I'm seeing now. And so events like the World Peace and Yoga Jubilee, to me, are so much more evolved and activated and realized. It's not potential anymore like it was back in the 60s. It's actually realization. So that for me, that's as Lily said, it's really heartwarming, and there's so much enthusiasm of the awareness that systemic change is really taking place on the planet, and it's the people on this call, people that are involved with the World Peace Diet, that are really leading the way. A lot of courageous, insightful people developing their intuition and really living a life of compassion and empathy. So great to be a part of that. I thank you, Will, I know Madeline's still out of town, but I thank her as well for really being at the heart of this movement and allowing others to join in and to really work arm in arm and to collaborate to really bring heaven on earth into our lives today, not some far off possibility, but really activating it and living it today.
Thank you, Mark. That's really beautifully said, and I really appreciate you coming from you especially. Gosh, you were way back there in the very beginning of this as a vegan in the days when people could, you know, weren't making that connection at all, and you were already starting to make it. So it's really good to realize that we are making progress. We are evolving in the direction of actually living peace, not just protesting about it, but actually embodying it and helping to create a field of consciousness for peace. And is there anything else you want to say before we do the wrap-up? We're getting about to the wrap-up here. So we just want to encourage everybody to join us at the Jubilee in Cincinnati the third week of October. If you have any friends, or even if you yourself would like to do a live version of the World Peace Eye Facilitator training there, it's a great opportunity, and we just love doing it. Mark, anything else? Or?
I will mention that there are a limited number of scholarships for anyone interested in the facilitator training, and they can go to worldpeaceyogajubilee.com, find out some information about that, or they can email Will or me, get in touch with. It's just a real powerful opportunity to change the world. So.
Right. Yeah, thanks. That's great. There's some scholarships, and the community there is very powerful. It just very often sets in motion changes that really can be very positively transformational. So, great, Mark. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hear
your ideas and thoughts. And all right, well, gosh, we only have a few minutes here before we're at the end of our call, and I'm so glad we have one on Tuesday, so we can talk a little bit more about some of the questions that came in. I realized after the fact, after Melanie was off, we had some more very excellent questions. There's one here about, can Melanie talk about how our brains are geared toward compassion? Very interesting. I have some things I could say about that, but we don't have time right now. But that's a good question. Another one about the... A long one about how the footage that in Australia came out about all the violence towards animals in Indonesia by the Australian people exporting the slaughtering of animals over there. And now it says, and she says, the Australian campaign against the animal export industry has now turned to television ads featuring meat processing in Australia, keeping jobs in Australia. The final scenes in the ad show meat workers smiling as they're about to go into the cool room. I can't tell you the sense of betrayal of the animals. And so it's very interesting how I can understand what she's saying, how the industry has used that outrage at the violence that was uncovered by the Indonesian workers, and now, of course, pretending that it's not, that killing the animals in Australia, there's not so much violence. and then another question, can you talk about how carnism relates to the oppression of women and the feminine spirit? So we talk a lot about that, of course, in the World Peace Diet, and there's definite connections we can explore on that some more as well. And I just want to close by mentioning a little bit more good news. One thing, as Mark said, I think it's just great to see how the universe is offering us new opportunities for the message of compassion to get out into the world. Some benefactors in Healdsburg, where I used to live, and when I lived there, they did not live there. They moved. You know, I moved out of Healdsburg 18 years ago, and I've been living on the road in a home on wheels for 18 years now. 16 years. 16 years ago, moved out. But after we moved there, these other people moved in, and they became passionate vegans and read the World Peace Diet and decided to just fund this space to spread the message. And so on Monday, the realization of this dream, which in many ways, I remember when I was way out on the ridge in Healdsburg and was so much contemplating how I could bring the message of compassion for animals into the world, and to see how whenever we put out in spirit, whatever we put out in our consciousness, it does return. You know, it took 16 years, but here it has returned. And in Healdsburg, of all the, you know, hundreds of thousands of communities in the United States where it could have happened, it's Healdsburg. You know, this unrelated, I never met them before, and we were in San Francisco, and we met and by chance, because we spend very little time actually in Northern California at all nowadays. Most in the eastern United States, and so we've got this center. We are hoping that we'll be able to offer more and more classes there. I'll be giving a talk there on Monday night. And so I encourage everyone, if you're interested in opening centers in your area, maybe to find out, we can work together. We can find people who can help that financially. We're working on creating a 501c3 that should be ready before long. Also to help with donations and things. So, I think the main thing is to just continue to do the work that we're doing. And maybe I'll just close with this true story that just happened, which is that, years ago when I was in Detroit, I remember I gave a talk on the World Peace Diet in this park, and it really wasn't many people there. There was only about 20 people, I guess, or maybe 30, 35, something like that. But one of them was this young man with bright eyes, and he really seemed to love what I was saying about compassion for animals and health and spirituality. And he bought a book afterwards, and he told me he was a yoga teacher and had a local yoga studio, and could I give a talk at his studio? And I said, well, it has to be tomorrow because I'm leaving the next day, which is in Detroit. And so he said, no problem. And so I went to his studio the next night, and he had gathered 60 people at his studio, and they listened to my talk there, and they bought, some books for the studio and so forth. And the years went by, and then right before I went on my retreat, I had a call from the publisher, Martin Rowe, and he said, Will, I just want to tell you that we have got a huge order came in from a company called Lifetime Fitness, which is a huge corporation in Minneapolis, based there, but I mean, they have a chain of fitness centers, high-end, it's hundreds of millions of dollars corporation throughout the United States, and they just got an order for 5,000 World Peace Diets, and this big corporation is ordering 5,000 of our books to give out to everybody who's taking their yoga classes. And he said, is there any mistake? Do you know any of these people? And I said, oh, I hope it's not a mistake. You know, he said, it's a very radical book. I don't know if they really want this book. And I said, well, I don't know. And so when I came back from the retreat, I checked with Lantern Books, and they had called in the meantime and found out, they asked, so why do you want to order 5,000 copies? And this is 5,000 copies every year, she said, well, our yoga instructor, our yoga guru has told us that he wants everybody to read this book. And she said, so who is this person? And she said, well, his name is Johnny Kest. And I really couldn't believe it. This was the same guy, Johnny Kest, who heard me speak many, 4 years earlier in this little park in Detroit and had his own little studio, has now been placed over this entire huge corporate yoga system with people in cities all over the United States, and he has made it a required reading for everyone who takes yoga. So I think this is another example of the doors opening and how if we just keep doing the work that we're here to do and just put one foot in front of the other and tell, you never know who might be Johnny Kest, the person you're talking to, who buys a book or who says, okay, I'm going to go vegan. They may end up being the catalyst for millions of people going vegan because each one of us has enormous potential. And I think that the tempo is quickening. Momentum is building, and it's really time for us to have a transformation on this planet. I just wrote an article and posted it yesterday. I don't know if you've seen it, but feel free if you want to read it. It's at vegsource.com, vegsource.com. Just go to Will Tuttle. My newest article is there, and it talks a little bit about some of these connections between animal foods and our crisis. Anyway, I'd like to wrap it up. I'd like to thank Steve. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. We've run out of time again, but it's been really enriching for me, and I hope for you. Please remember next month, on the 15th, we'll have Colleen Patrick Goudreau, the third Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, and then our first time, Tuesday, September 6th, same time, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, we'll have just a chance if you'd like to just talk and share and answer some more questions. There's a lot of great questions being discussed on the forum. I wasn't able to talk about some of those things, but the Ode magazine and a whole lot of other things. So keep up the great work you're doing. You're not alone. We're all in this together. We're doing it for the animals and for people, for future generations, for the earth, and really for ourselves, for the joy that comes into our hearts when we connect with the truth that we are and we realize that everything that we say and do does make a difference and we can transform our culture. There's really nothing stopping us as human beings except for the habits which can be changed. So much love to you all. Thanks again for joining us. Thank you, Steve. And we look forward to staying in touch and spread the message. Anyone who wants to take the World Peace Diet Facilitator Training or Mastery Program, we go to worldpeacemastery.com, and we have the training there is available to anyone. Thanks again, everyone, for joining us.